Okay. So tonight is the fourth in of the four-part series, the Corona Couples, Corona, and Creating the Next Chapter. And as I said last time, today I sort of conceptualize this installment as sort of part two of what we started last week. And just to remind you all, we sort of, the first 2 weeks were accepting, and the I named this the ABCDs of marriage, a new marriage in times of Corona. The first 2 weeks was accepting and attending to the real test of creating our couplehood. And B was building connection and relationship. And those 2 weeks were really about connecting and building and working on the positive and working on the relationship as a prerequisite to then going into tackling our differences. And that these 2 weeks were sort of a unit in addressing that. And C was cultivating curiosity and curbing contempt, so that we are better able to talk with each other about our differences. And tonight is D, which is for diffuse, so we can discuss. But again, it's a package deal. We need to do all parts of this in order to really solidify our relationship and attend to the things that we need to attend to without them eroding the positive. But at the same point, being able to actually attend to the things that we need to attend to. So just as a very brief recap, we talked last week about the fact that there are three different parts of addressing our differences that we're going to address and come at this issue with. And last week we spent the time talking about the intellectual or psychoeducational piece, what you need to know and what you need to understand intellectually, cognitively, psychologically, what you need to know, the tasks and the skills that you need to understand that are part of the right perspective on addressing our differences. And we talked about the idea of being curious rather than condemning, not approaching differences in a judgmental negative way, which shuts down the conversation right away, understanding what goes into really listening well and communicating well, the different skills and tools. And that tonight we're going to address the other thing that gets in the way of dealing with our differences, tackling them without tackling each other. That's the physiological component, what goes on inside us and what we need to understand about how we work on that level in order to attend to that piece, because that piece drives or shuts down the intellectual piece so that we can know all the things that we need to know about how to listen and what's a block to good listening and what's the correct idea about addressing differences, which is being curious. But if we don't attend to the physiological, the thing that we call stonewalling, where the person gets shut down or the person gets super activated and isn't really present and listening, if we don't attend to it on a physiological basis, we're still not going to be able to have the conversation that we need to have in order to address things in a way that does not erode our relationship. And then we're also going to sort of take all of this and put it together and talk about some practicalities. I'm going to use some examples that, you know, people have thrown at me or that have come up during this time, specifically in terms of the crisis of Corona. And we're going to use those examples to see, to work through or work out what it might look like if we take all of this knowledge and bring it together and address our differences in a way that can be satisfying enough to move us forward and done in a way that does not damage what we want to have here with each other. So tonight's going to be addressing the physiological piece of this. But before we go there, there was one more piece of the intellectual or psychoeducational component, in addition to the overarching concept of understanding that we want to approach our differences by being curious about them instead of condemning. I want you also, since tonight is D, to think about the difference between discussing and deciding. That one of the other sort of intellectual or psychoeducational constructs that get in people's way is that as soon as they start having a conversation about their differences, they think that this discussion is the decision-making process, and therefore I right away have to go in my defensive mode, in my fighting stance. I gotta stake my territory and I have to make my points. Which greatly reduces the likelihood that I'm going to be curious about you, that I'm going to be open to understanding you and understanding your perspective, because I'm thinking we're deciding now. And so I got to really get my point out. And so in addition to being curious, make sure, and we'll kind of weave this into the practical piece as well, but make sure that when you're having these discussions, you're thinking in terms of discussing and separate that from deciding, that you almost sort of have to agree with one another that I want to have 10 minutes, 20 minutes, I don't know, whatever, or tonight is discussion only. There will be no decision making here. There will be no conflict resolution here. We are just discussing and understanding each other. There will be nothing that happens from this discussion. And that can kind of give you that natural boundary that can help you, help signal yourself as a way of stopping you from getting into all of those, you know, blocks to good listening that we talked about last time, is this general principle of nothing's happening. You don't have to worry, nothing's happening. You're not giving up anything. You're not agreeing to anything. You're not changing anything, because tonight is just discussing. And that frees me up to be able to hear, because nothing's happening. We're just talking and I'm just understanding you. So I can relax and just really work at understanding you, because nothing's at stake, because tonight is just discussion. And that's often kind of the way that you want to handle these hot button topics that might come up between the two of you, is really taking a night between discussion and deciding, that conflict management, conflict resolution, compromise phase of things needs to happen on a different night than the discussion. So that was just one more sort of cognitive piece that I wanted you all to think about and try and incorporate into how you're going to go about doing these things or discussing these things and negotiating these issues. So the last thing also that I want to bring in from last week is that I talked to you, I asked you all to bring into mind a difference of your own. I threw out some examples that have come to me, people who don't, you know, really enjoy the same things and have the same kind of ideas about downtime or vacation time or free time, or it could be about how I handle stress in the middle of Corona. I want to know everything, all the details, and watch CNN 24/7, or I don't want to hear the news unless I need to know about what something is closed or something is open, or I can go here or I can't go there. I don't want to know. So, you know, I threw out a bunch of examples, but I really want you to try and think of a difference that's yours. And we're going to, again, utilize that tonight, especially in a practical way. When we're talking about the physiological, I really want you to have it in mind so that you can embody and feel the lesson that we're going to be addressing tonight. because tonight is about that feeling state and how it can truly get in the way and almost, you know, overthrow completely everything that you know intellectually. If we don't address this piece, then everything that you learned in last week's piece is almost going to be useless. And so this is really key. And I want you to use that example that you have in mind to really kind of feel what I'm talking about as we go through what we're going to be going through tonight. Okay. So I am going to be talking about the physiological barriers and struggles that we go through when we find that we have differences with our spouse. Now, I'm going to be bringing in, as has been brought in very much to the field of psychology, the field of neurobiology and neuropsychology, the understanding of the brain and how the brain function interacts with our physical function. And I'm going to be trying to keep it as light as possible. I'm not, you know, a science brain myself, so you don't have to worry about it being heavy on the science piece. But what I'm going to be talking to you is has been very much studied by the neuropsychologists and psychiatrists in the field, and it has greatly enhanced our ability to understand what goes on psychologically and enhanced our ability to address what goes on for us psychologically. And most therapists these days have some fundamental rudimentary understanding of this, especially if you deal with trauma, because what we've come to understand is that strictly talking ourselves into a better place has a limitation. There's been tremendous work that people have done in strictly talk therapy, but what we're understanding and realizing is that, especially in trauma, but in other areas as well, when we understand how things affect us physiologically, how distress works in our bodies, and we attend to that and not just try and talk ourselves into a better place in terms of how we think, but also understand how our body and our reaction inside is affected by that and affects that, things are just much easier to accomplish. Our goals of what we want to accomplish are much easier to accomplish. So one of sort of the most popular neuropsychiatrists is a man named Dan Siegel. I think a psychiatrist, not psychologist. And there's another neuropsychiatrist, Bessel van der Kolk, and they have both done a lot of work and a lot of helping us understand how these two things combine. Our thought and our brain, but also our body and our reactions. And Dan Siegel created this sort of little, no pun intended, he likes the pun or doesn't, I'm not sure, of a handy tool for us to understand it. And he uses his hand as a model for the brain to help us understand what's going on for us. And some of you might be familiar with this, and if you're not, it's pretty simple but key in addressing our conflicts as couples. So he uses the hand and he talks about how sort of the palm, the lower part, is what we would refer to as the brain stem. It's the most basic primitive part of the brain. It is what controls all of our automatic functioning, our heartbeat, our digestion, our blood flow, our breathing, all the things we don't have to think about, that they're just kind of there, is controlled by the brainstem. And then he talks about how the upper palm, thumb area of our hand is the limbic area. And the limbic area controls or holds emotion. It is the what he calls the appraiser of significance. It tells you how important or how significant something is. It is overlaid and has memories in this region they're controlled in this region. And that's the limbic area and the amygdala, what he refers to as the amygdala, and uses the thumb to connote the amygdala. We'll refer to as our early warning signal. The amygdala, the emotion, the appraiser of significance that kind of lets you know when something's not right, which starts firing and releasing certain chemicals in our body when something isn't right, whether it's adrenaline, whether it's cortisol. We have these drugs that are released in our body when things are looking shaky or dangerous, threatening in some way. It starts firing and letting us know that, but it's not really sophisticated enough, or it doesn't necessarily differentiate between danger, threat, that's, you know, a lion coming at us, and danger, threat of a spouse that's really angry and overwhelming, or a situation that threatens to possibly mean that things are not going to be the way I thought they were going to be. And that's sort of held in this region. And what is connoted sort of by this upper piece is what we would call the cortex, prefrontal, frontal cortex. Won't get into all the different specifics. But in here, the overlay that's in here are what it controls and holds are things like our thought and our speech, our sequencing, you know, when that happened versus when that happened, our ability to be in tune and attuned with somebody else, compassion and empathy, our response, what he calls our response flexibility, that we can, you know, consider and decide and be flexible, and even something that is our center for calming our fear, the thing that releases a different chemical into the body that can help us calm our fear. And Dr. Van de Kolk did some studies with fMRI machines, and which are imaging of the brain, inducing trauma in people, and being able to see that when we are triggered with stress, fear, trauma, feelings of threat and danger, this whole piece that controls our thought and our speech and our attunement and compassion and our empathy and goes dark, obviously to a greater or lesser degree, depending on how severe the shutdown is, how drastic the feeling of threat is. But what Dr. Siegel explains is that this early warning signal, this limbic amygdala area that starts to get shaky and starts to get emotional and starts to appraise the significance of things, but maybe isn't too terribly sophisticated in knowing danger from danger, or maybe our association with something changing is that it's very dangerous to us, literally, if that's how it feels, is that when this starts cooking, what he calls flips our lid. So that this part, as they saw in the fMRI machines, are not available to us. They're dark, or to some lesser or greater degree, they're not available to us. When we are highly emotional and associating with scarier times in our life, and feeling threatened, feeling like we're in danger, what happens is that our ability to think clearly, to speak rationally, to be attuned, to be compassionate, to be empathetic, etc., is not available to us. And we might feel a flood. We might feel a numbing, a complete shutdown, which is sort of the other response, what the Gottmans call stonewalling, where you're just shut down. Some people look shut down, but really what's going on is that they're so flooded inside, they just, to control it, go blank on the outside, and they're not really blank at all. They're flooded. Some people, with their flooding, they get very loud and very irrational, or very unavailable to talk. They're yelling, or they're not listening. And as you can imagine, the ability to be curious, to remember that we're just discussing, the understanding and remembering of all of those points of what to do when you're listening and what not to do, they're just not available to us. Our thought process is not available to us in the same way as when we're internally calmed. When this is firing because we're feeling threatened and we feel like there's something dangerous going on, it's very nice and well and good to say, but remember, be curious. Or remember, we're just discussing. But if we only, it's sort of a catch-22, because when we're in that spot, we don't have our brain fully available to us. So how are we remembering all those things we learned? We've lost it to some degree. And even if we do remember it, if we're so flooded with adrenaline and cortisol because of that feeling of threat, being able to take what we know, we think we know, maybe we still know it to some degree, and put it into action is severely hampered. And so just dealing with what we dealt with last time, in terms of the intellectual piece, the lessons, and not dealing with how do I get myself back down? How do I get myself back online? All of me, my compassion and my empathy and my response flexibility and my attunement and my thought and my speech. How do I get it back online? I'm just going to try and think my way back online. Again, I think I said last time, it's sort of like trying to talk yourself out of a fever. We need to do something. We need to attend to what's going on inside of us. And so what we've come to understand is the importance of attending to the physiological. And there's lots of different ways to do that. And there's specific ways that we're going to talk about, self-soothing, specific self-soothing techniques that are simple. Some are, you know, more immediate and some are more long-term. There's the understanding that you might want to make between you and your spouse that if you're going to need a break to get back down to baseline, to be able to stay curious, that you agree that if you're feeling kind of not present, that we have a code word. And I can use that code word to kind of take a 30-minute break and try and get back down to baseline. It's really, really important that nobody use the excuse of that break to go into avoidance mode, because spouses who avoid often get chased. If I know that you taking a break to self-soothe means we're not coming back to this conversation. You're not going to suggest it. You're not going to come and say, hey, we need to, you know, what are you, I'm ready to finish this if you are, that you're going to use the opportunity to, you know, run away or avoid in some way, that I'm going to start chasing you. And guess what gets my adrenaline running, amongst other things? Being chased. So it's not going to be good for my spouse. It's not going to be good for me. It's not going to be good for addressing the issue, because we're just recreating the same sort of panicked emotional feeling and physiologically panicked feeling. So it's really the responsibility of the person who needs the break and asks for the break to be responsible. We talked about responsibility for self in the marriage in the first session, I think, to be responsible to say, I need 30 minutes. Let me get back to baseline. And can we meet back here in 30 minutes? And if not, because in 30 minutes I have a class, or you have a class, or you have to go out for I don't know what, then I need to, you know, get back to baseline. Can we pick this up? Whatever works. And to take that responsibility seriously, so that you can not set up the cycle of chase and retreat and chase and retreat. So that's one piece to remember, that it's okay to need that break. It's not a cop out per se. It's not a cop out on your spouse's part, but it's going to be really hard for somebody not to view it that way if the other person, or the person who asks for it, doesn't take responsibility to come back to the conversation. So let's talk about what it looks like to either take that break, or in the moment to work on, and I keep breathing for a reason, to work on getting back to basics, getting back to baseline physiologically, so that I can remember that I want to be, that we're not deciding, we're just discussing, and that I want to be curious and really understand your position. And that even when we get to deciding, it's never going to be, maybe not never, but it's not going to be a situation where I'm going to have to agree to something that I can't live with. That should be an agreement between the two of you. Now, if somebody is unable to live with anything other than how things are their way all the time, that's problematic. And you need intervention of the professional sort beyond just a four-part workshop, because there should be the ability to compromise, which we'll talk about what that really means. There should be the ability to compromise if both people are compromising, sometimes me more, sometimes you more. But if I feel safe, if I feel like we really are doing this in a way that is for both of us and from both of us, then it shouldn't be that I can't, everything that isn't my way is a complete and total disaster and, you know, horror, and I can't handle it. And if that's not true, because I can, then when you get to compromise mode, you can remind yourself as a way of intellectually starting to bring yourself back to basic, back to baseline, that I'm not ever going to have to agree to something that I really absolutely cannot live with. So that's a different piece. So how do I bring myself back down? I'm flooded. I'm not thinking. I'm feeling my heart rate or my face flushed or my sweating or all of those sort of lower brain functions that get activated by the rush of adrenaline and cortisol. How do I get back down? So one of the simplest self-soothing methods for getting back down is the use of breathing. Now, the breathing that's really important the slow breath that's really important is the out breath. The in breath, if everyone can do it with me now, if you, sorry, if you take a deep breath in, that's not really relaxing. If you can feel that, that kind of, if you're already tense and you're already aggravated and you're already distressed, the is not what's going to be relaxing you. Okay. Now, I'm not suggesting that you do that quick, short in breath. It should also be slow. But as you'll feel when we do it, it's the slow out breath that really starts to relax us and help those chemicals sort of work through the system. So let's try that. We're going to take a count of seven in. We're going to hold for four, and then we're going to go out for 8 seconds. Okay, so it looks like this. Wait, it looks like this. And then again. Now, hopefully you can all feel how that slow, deep in and hold and the slow out can get you into a calming place. If you can't remember the numbers or then it's too much for you for whatever reason, you can do less, but always have a little bit longer out than in. Have all the breathing be slow. And that's one of your most powerful and partially because it's one of your most easily accessed self-soothing tools to really sort of take a break from what's going on and do some deep breathing. Now, sometimes depending on the degree of distress that the conversation is creating, maybe just taking some deep breaths in and out as you listen is enough that you don't actually need the break from the conversation, but you needed to stop holding your breath and really let it out so that while you're having the conversation, just to make sure you're staying even and you're staying present and you're staying compassionate and you're staying curious and you're staying on track. And then there are going to be some times where taking a break from the conversation and just breathing isn't enough either. And a lot of the experts on self-soothing will tell you that there's lots of different things that we can use to bring ourselves back to baseline physiologically so that we no longer feel the running, the rushing, the heart racing, the sweating palms, the stomach aches, the knots, the butterflies, the whatever those physiological sensations that you might be experiencing, the tightness, chest, throat. There's all sorts of physiological responses you might be feeling. And when the breathing isn't enough, so one of the ways you can think about some other types, more involved types of self-soothing exercises, one of the shorthands that we use, again, the hand, one of the shorthands we use to kind of help you think about all the different ways that we might be able to kind of soothe ourselves is to think along the lines of the five senses. And within the five senses, think of different things that help, that make you feel calm, that have the ability to sort of get you into a different mode, get you into a different feeling, get you out of a negative, distressed place. So if you think along the five senses and you think in terms of touch, touch might be that I have a stress ball. Touch might be that I have some, you know, kinetic sand that I play with. Touch might be that I go wash the dishes if I find that soothing, relaxing, takes me kind of out of my mood or mode. It might be that I like to bake and I go bake something. It might be that I like to tinker with tools, put something together, take something apart, fix something. And that's touch. Taste, I think, is probably obvious. This is not to encourage emotional eating necessarily in an unhealthy way, but a hot drink, a cold drink, sometimes it can relate to the touch because you like to sit with a hot drink and feel it and drink it and it's soothing. It might be something that, you know, in a moderated way that you like to eat or you like to taste or you like to have. It might relate to smell. Maybe there's the smell of the hot drink or the smell of the, we're onto the third sense. The smell of the baking food. It could be another kind of on the sense of smell. Some people find it very soothing to be outside and to smell, you know, nature of some sort. Some people like to have, you know, spices available because that they find that scent very soothing to them. There's also sight, and for some people it is the seeing nature. You know, some of these can kind of travel on multiple wavelengths to kind of look at the ocean, smell the ocean, look at the ocean. Now that's often available at our fingertips for a lot of people. Sight, seeing, reading something, learning something, watching something, other things that kind of just relax us, make us feel relaxed. Or hearing, and the last one is hearing, listening to music or talking to someone else to sort of change the channel and get engaged in some other conversation, or to listen to something meaningful. And obviously there are people who don't have all five senses available to them. Some people can't hear and some people can't see. And so that just means that you want to think of extra examples in the other areas of the other senses to make sure that you have a very rich resource box, so to speak, a box of things, of ideas, of what makes me feel relaxed, what makes me feel comforted, what in that way that can really soothe me back to a place of calm inside, where I'm no longer experiencing that flood and that feeling of overwhelm physically. And so go through those and make a note to yourself of things that can make you feel calm and soothed in the moment of feeling flooded and distressed. And if I can kind of ask you all to think about that example that I asked you to have in mind, the example of a difference that causes you distress and gets in the way, creates a struggle between the two of you. think about it. See if you can, as you think about it, find it in your body, how it makes you feel inside, whether it's that flush of rage, stress, anger, fear, worry, whether it's heavy in your chest or in your throat or an all over kind of feeling of tense, flooded. And just sort of practice while holding that. Practice that breathing through those physiological symptoms. Getting yourself back into a calm place. You may or may not have any of the other things available to you in this moment. I didn't have you, you know, make sure to bring a hot drink or a cold drink or a stress ball for the session. But that's okay. Just practice at least breathing through the distress when you kind of bring up that struggle in your mind. Because once you can bring yourself back, you can remind yourself that you need to be curious to understand that you're just discussing, not deciding. And that even when you get to deciding, to talking about compromising and deciding, you don't have to agree to something in its entirety that you can't live with. That's what compromise means, that you're not going to live with something in its entirety. You're not going to have to agree to something in its entirety to live with. But you need to be in that calm place to be able to have that in your mind and to be able to go forward to talk about compromise without going back up into your activated nervous system where you don't think properly and you can't respond and you can't find empathy and compassion. So once you're back down, now we can talk about compromise and breathe. Compromise doesn't mean one thing. A lot of people, when they think about compromise, they think it means, you know, we split things halfway in the middle. But not all problems can be split halfway in the middle. I want to live here and you want to live there. Like, we're not living some of the time here and some of the time there. You know, 6 months a year here and 6 months a year here. Usually. Not for young people. Maybe older people, they retire, they're 6 months away. But it's not, that's not what it means in many of our struggles, that we're going to split things evenly, or that there even is an even split. You know, where a child's going to go to school, well, they're not going to go to school half a year here and half a year there. Doesn't work like that. Compromise can look in a few different ways. One is splitting things evenly, and we'll talk about some examples of that. But sometimes compromise means that some things go my spouse's way in this area. If something can go my way in another area. So sometimes compromise means that, yes, this thing is, I can deal with. As long as I know that this thing is going to be the way it's important to me. And, you know, for some couples, the reaction is, it sounds kind of businesslike, it sounds kind of, you know, practical, very formal, very whatever. And it kind of is, because where there isn't the ability for us to split it or have it be in a way that we're both coming forward, because it doesn't go like that. Sometimes what we would rather do is create sort of that business negotiation so that we can both feel satisfied if that works in a particular situation, so that we can both feel satisfied so that we're not tackling each other. You know, one of the things we talked about is that the reason that people are not, are often have a hard time addressing their struggle and really dealing with the struggle as a struggle is because they don't want to admit to themselves that we're struggling, because maybe that means we're not a good couple. We don't agree enough. We're not alike enough. So maybe we're not a good couple. And we want to feel like a good couple and really like in this together and close and aligned and alike and all of that. And if we're making this like deal, that sounds like a business deal. We're making this deal. You'll get this and I'll get this. All of a sudden, we're not that like warm, mushy couple. But people are misreading things and misunderstanding things when they think that that warm, mushy couple who's going to kill each other trying to get the other one to agree with them is better off than the couple who can step away from the problem, negotiate it like a business, and then go back to their relationship, is in a much better place. This couple that is insisting sort of on symbiosis, on almost enmeshment, they're making each other miserable. If they could step away from each other enough to say, okay, let's do a deal, then when we come together, we're happy. We're enjoying each other. We've dealt with our difference. We've gotten together and made it the problem. And now we've dealt with it and we're good. And so it might sound kind of business-like, but if I can live with you having this as long as I have that, we're going to be in a much healthier, happier place. So don't discount that as a tool for dealing with your differences or difficulties. Another way that compromise could be understood is that sometimes it's this time it'll go my way and next time it'll go my spouse's way, right? It really depends on what the struggle is. Can it be split? Three different possibilities so far that we're talking about. Can it be split evenly? Is it something that I get my way and therefore, and something else, you'll get your way? Or another type of compromise is this time my way, that time your way. So let's say a couple likes to watch the news. And one wants to, or let's say they, you know, in the evening, they like to watch something together. And one who is, you know, very worried or just interested, depending on where it's coming from, again, you have to be curious to find out, wants to be watching CNN. I want to know the news. I want to hear what's doing. I want to know what's going on with this corona business. I want to know what's happening. I want to know what's going on now with this. And the other one wants to like disappear from life and stress. And, you know, can we watch something completely fictional? I don't know. So if we're looking at the three different types of compromise that could be done, let's say we have an hour. If our way of compromising is we're splitting things evenly, so I get a half hour my way and you get a half hour your way. If we're looking at the tactic, at the tool, or the possibility of I have something my way and you get something else your way, then maybe you get to watch CNN the whole time, every night, and I get to decorate the living room in flowers from top to bottom. I don't know, whatever. One of those things where we don't, are in no way close to each other's idea, interest, ability, whatever. And we just sort of say, there isn't like half a room in flowers and half a room in stripes. So I really want the flowers and you really want all CNN all the time. So we're gonna do our compromise that way. And in the third type of compromising, something where my way this time, your way that time. So then obviously this, the example would be, you know, tonight is CNN and tomorrow night is, whatever, something that is completely not related to reality. So hopefully I've made it clear the different types of compromise that there might be. Let's take something that's not corona related, right? Let's take the couple I was thinking of who don't enjoy the same type of downtime or the same type of, you know, together time, going out time. They don't. So one compromise that we talked about was alternating times. This time, this week when we go out, it's completely my type and my time. And next week is completely your type and your time. And one of the struggles that comes up when you use that compromise, which is why I want to raise it, is, you know, one of the complaints often is, but you know, how can I, you know, where am I supposed to put myself with that? I really, really, really don't enjoy X, whatever, hikes in the woods. And so one of the things you might want to think about is, can you enjoy your spouse's enjoyment? If this is the way you've decided to compromise, can you put yourself somewhere so that we're still together in this? Right? Because obviously doing downtime together where one is, you know, going to sulk and be miserable is not really going to be conducive to the relationship. So sometimes it takes saying to myself, can I enjoy that my spouse enjoys this? Can I be understanding, going back to the CNN Corona example, can I be understanding that my spouse really needs to know or finds it really fascinating to know? Can I be happy that they are, you know, calmed or soothed by this? Going the other way, can I understand that this causes my spouse a lot of distress? Maybe we don't want to be, we don't want our compromise to be that sometimes it's this way and sometimes it's that way. Maybe we want to do the, you know, a different kind of compromise where we don't do this together. You know, you really have to decide how significant it is, because obviously if you don't enjoy doing any outings the same type, you, as a couple, it doesn't make sense for us to never do any outings with each other. I go hiking with my friends and you go out to eat with your friends and we never enjoy each other. You have to kind of look and say, does that make sense for our relationship? Or can we figure out how I'm going to go out to eat with you and enjoy that you enjoy this, and you're going to come on a hike with me and enjoy that I enjoy this. But maybe I don't need to sit through CNN. Maybe it's okay if you watch CNN alone and I, you know, listen to music alone, because it's not really bonding time anyway. If I do find it bonded, because then we can talk about it, then I might need to figure out a different compromise. But if I've been curious and I keep in mind that we'll keep discussing and we'll keep discussing so that I don't have to agree to anything that's unlivable, then we can probably talk around this in ways and stretch it and pull it until it fits both of us. Even things that didn't seem like they had the ability to kind of fit both of our lives before. And what if not? What if there's really something that's just not, we aren't able to, we're not figuring it out, it's stressing us, it's distressing us, it's getting in the way. Well, the question is who do you have to speak to? Is there someone that can help you that's outside of the relationship that can help you figure out something either that you haven't thought of or help you figure out how to hold the difference, if possible, to hold the difference without it crushing one or the other of you? There are certain differences and struggles that we have that are really hard to figure out. Most, if we stay calm and we stay open and we're willing to play with different possibilities, most are surmountable. But I'm not going to just pass over and pretend Pollyanna it that, you know, all of them are surmountable. And that's when you want to have sort of an outside person that you both trust and feel comfortable speaking with that can help you figure out what you're going to do with this struggle that you're not able to kind of move forward with on your own. Don't always think about, you know, doing it on your own. If you're trying and you're trying and you're trying and you're not able, it's not going anywhere. Don't keep that up for so long that it wears on you and wears on the relationship. Try and get some intervention sooner rather than later so you don't see it erode away the good cheer and the good feelings and the good connection that you hopefully are working on building with your gift registry and with your understanding of yourself and sharing it with your spouse. Try and get some help with that sooner rather than later. So that wraps up part 4 of 4. Let me see about Q&A. Everyone has their views that they want to get across and may be afraid that one's viewpoint may be forgotten. So sometimes we overspeak our mates. That's true. Figuring out a way to make sure that both are getting heard is really important. One of the ways to do that is to be mindful and in conversation with your spouse that I really want to have a conversation about something, and let's, you know, each get to speak our mind fully. I want to make sure that you feel like I've fully heard you, and I hope you'll make sure that I'm fully heard as well. So that's having it in mind and being open about what your needs are really an important piece of this. You can't have a relationship alone. There has to be a partner there who's interested and willing to be in this with you. It doesn't work one person by themselves. What about a difference of opinion that both feel strongly on and can't find a middle ground? Where to send kids to yeshiva? Again, why, you know, people have outside mentors, Rav, mentor, trusted adult in their life. That's why that's important, because there will be here and there things that come up that are not compromisable, where we're going to send the kids to yeshiva is not going to be 6 months here, 6 months there. Sometimes couples figure out, okay, you're going to pick the boys' school and I'm going to pick the girls' school. Sometimes that works for certain couples, but it won't work for other couples. So that's not, you know, always possible. Some other comments. Deciding is attempting to please the other person is more important than my needs, desires, or wants. Not sure if that's a question. Compromise should not be based upon a person changing a personality trait that has been a part of your character for years. Right? Compromise is not about your personality trait. Compromise is about how you're going to manage your struggles. If what your spouse is struggling with is a personality trait of yours, that's going to be very difficult to negotiate. On the other hand, not on the other hand, what is usually easier to deal with is the effects of that personality trait. Can I make a request to have this or that thing, as opposed to, can you not be, I can't stand that you're so, it's looking and saying, you know, your messiness is a struggle for me. It's very difficult. The messiness in the house is very difficult. The disorganization in the closets and the whatever is very difficult. Can we figure something out? Because it feels very distracting or distressing to me. Can we figure something out? What part of that, what part, you know, is mine in that? Can I facilitate? What part can you facilitate? So there are different ways and different approaches depending on what the issue is. Okay, everybody. Thanks so much for your attention out there and your feedback, from the feedback that I've gotten. I really appreciate it. And I hope it was helpful and informative. And I thank you all. Take care.